Talk given Saturday, 21st February, 1976. We can never overemphasize the importance of right attentiveness where the living of the religious life is concerned. And nor can I repeat too often that the religious life must not be regarded as something separate from, something different from the secular life. If the whole religious spirit does not completely infuse itself through and through the secular life, then what we commonly call religion is not the reality of religion. Because religiousness is perhaps the supremely outstanding characteristic of the animal species which is called Homo sapiens, man. All man's problems, troubles, difficulties, his ill state, his confusions, his fears, and so forth, stem from the fact that he is ignorant of the true nature of religiousness which lies within him and distinguishes him. And it is this religiousness which has to come to fruition. And its meaning is something quite different from what the world at large, throughout the ages, has considered religiousness to be. You know how the world at large thinks of the religious man or the religious life as one who worships some supreme power or a supreme being, who acknowledges or confesses his belief in a particular creed, a doctrine, a dogma, and so forth. And to a certain extent, who tries to support and to live out what is commonly called the good life, the moral life, in terms of what we ordinarily call the various virtues. This is the average conception, and man as a whole is rather lukewarm as far as his determination to live these virtues is concerned. He compromises. And he compromises for various reasons, mainly the fact that he is driven by his natural urges for pleasure, for self-assertion. And if he is driven by pleasure and driven by self-assertion, then he lives at the expense of his environment, which includes numbers of other human beings who are also driven in that manner. The result is there is no social harmony. There is no sense of being a member of the human race as such. And therefore, people's interests, their ideas of how things should be done, and so forth, are always at variance with each other. At the root of it all, people are self-preoccupied. The mind is always occupied with the desires, the problems, the fears, the ambitions, and so forth, which beset each person. And this self-preoccupation makes it impossible for a man to attend, to be attentive to life, the whole of life, from moment to moment, in the right way. Practically all mankind, with very few exceptions, is attentive in the self-oriented way, in the way of isolation from the whole. One is always looking for one's personal gain, one's personal pleasure, one's personal security, success, happiness, and so forth. And therefore, with this type of attentiveness, a man is wholly ignorant of how the psyche functions. He just doesn't understand that he is expending his energies in destroying himself, in harming and hurting himself. And if he harms and hurts himself to start with, it is impossible for him to avoid harming and hurting others around him and spoiling his whole environment. So the question arises, what are the principal factors involved in right attentiveness? Of course, first and foremost, a man must have the power to attend. If he is so constituted that his mind wanders away easily here or there, if it so happens that he cannot be fully awake in the moment, right now, where he is, then he will not attend to things in the right way. You know the common experience of so many. A person is in London and he wants to be in the country. It would be so lovely in the country. He is in the country and he says, oh, it's so quiet and there are nothing around, to no excitement, nothing very interesting, and he wants to be in London. Now, if a person is in that absurdly childish state, that absurdly fragmented state within himself, how can he pay attention to the immediate now? This is the great problem. To be able to pay attention to the immediate now. Now, I mentioned one or two trite instances. A person in London wants to be in the country, and the same man in the country wants to be back in London. But trite instances of that sort tell us something of the workings of his psyche which distract his attention. When he's in the country, he hasn't got enough excitements, and therefore he wants to come back to the town. In the town, there is too much noise and bustle and all the rest of it, and he wants to go into the country. So he is the victim of conflicting desires. This is the problem. And he desires that which is not here. This again shows us something very important with respect to the nature of desire. It is always for that which one does not possess, which is not here. No, perhaps not always, because if a person has, say, plenty of wealth, he desires still more wealth. All right, but those are not the usual conditions. Usually, what is not here, a possessiveness. And what lies at the back of such possessiveness and this kind of functioning of desire? The subconscious feeling that if he has this, that, or the other, he will be happy and secure. These are two fundamental drives in the whole organism. Nature's bequest to us. We are conditioned by the evolutionary process from our primordial ancestor in such a manner that these drives are in us. If we go into these for ourselves fairly deeply, we will see how our conditioning through evolution, nature's legacy to us, and our conditioning by our socio-cultural tradition puts all hindrances in our way as regards pure attentiveness. If you take socio-cultural conditioning, you will see how the mind is straight-laced. It has to interpret and think and plan out courses of action in accordance, in conformity with that which is imposed upon us by our society. Now, this is not to suggest that what society imposes is wrong or evil necessarily, nor is it ever completely right, wholly pure or beneficial, because all our socio-cultural conditioning has arisen out of the empirical experience of the race in its particular situation, and all the various influences which have played upon that race historically. So it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And the this and the that are in conflict. Now the mind is conditioned that way, so that the person is not free to exercise real intelligence in the immediate moment. Whatsoever impression comes to him through his senses, whatsoever he digs out of his memory, is something which is distorted by this conditioned mind. It is interpreted correctly up to a point, and it is misinterpreted beyond that point. Very often the misinterpretation outweighs the correct interpretation, and so the person is in this inner turmoil which prevents him from being wholly attentive to what is actually present. Now, all religious disciplines, all mystical disciplines, all yoga or any such discipline is directed towards the cleansing and the maturing of the mind in such a manner that one is freed from the limitations imposed by our environment, our socio-cultural heritage, and our natural urges. All these forces, our natural urges, for example, are the expressions of nature's blueprint with which we start. From conception onwards, the genes and the hormones and so forth determine the general pattern of the individual, psychophysically. Not merely physically, but psychophysically. There is a blueprint. Now, man is so endowed that he has considerable scope for adaptation and adaptability. There is considerable elasticity allowed him. And if there is something in him which is concerned with truth, with reality, with understanding himself, really understanding himself, then he can not override, but adapt himself to his circumstance in such a manner that the limitations imposed upon him by that blueprint do not prevent him from expressing to the full what is possible for him to express. Now, this needs that urge, that other urge within him to come into operation. I've talked of of the imprint upon us through nature. There is this other urge, which we can call the pull or the drawing power, the educating power of transcendence itself. Let us not look at this as if transcendence were something other than nature, which exerts a pull in this, that, or the other way, which is different from or opposed to the drive of nature. That would be a mistaken way of looking at it. This urge for transcendence, which is inherent in us human beings particularly, has the best chance of coming to fruition through us rather than through any other animal species, because we have the power which no other animal species has, certainly to the extent that we have, of being awake to our own withinness. And through being awake to our own withinness and realizing our own limitations and littleness in the vast universe in which we live, we become aware of this great overriding reality, which is the totality, the whole, and that we are just part and parcel of this totality. So this sense of transcendence is a power that draws us all the time. Now, we find that the two nature's push and drive on the one hand, and this urge, this pull of transcendence on the other hand, do not quite tally. They seem to be contrarywise to each other. The one seems to be like the law of the jungle, and the other we call the law of the spirit. And they both meet in us, and it is a fact that man, through the urges, has regarded these two as contradictory forces, conflicting forces. Now, in actual fact, they are not conflicting forces. There is, if we may so put it, this middle region, which is our own psyche. And our psyche is quite different in its possibilities, its potentialities, from the psyche of the animal, of any other animal species. We have a psyche which is, and a mind which is quite different from that of the animal as such. This mind is the victim of our socio-cultural conditioning. And when I say socio-cultural, I'm not restricting the word cultural just to art, science, philosophy, but to our innermost and deepest beliefs with regard to this which is transcendent and which we only dimly sense or perceive. Now, this is the region where we can realize complete freedom, this region of the mind. Physically, no one in the world can realize total freedom, quite impossible. It's not in the nature of limited, finite, physical things to realize such freedom. But in mind and consciousness, there seems to be no limit. No limit whatsoever. The mind cannot merely make a thought form, and present concepts in verbal patterns of that which is infinite, which is immeasurable, which is altogether transcendent, in relation to our ordinary concepts and feelings and forms of speech and so on. There is nothing to prevent mind from realizing that infinitude. Now, the realizing of that infinitude is the meaning of the transformation of your mode of awareness. The transformed mode of awareness is characterized by a transformed mode of attentiveness. The person who is aware in terms of the immeasurable, the infinite, attends totally unself-orientedly. This is the point. He attends unself-consciously. Now, we've got the key. This is the key, the technical key, to unlock the gates of the kingdom of heaven, to open the doors of the deathless, as the Buddha said. The way one attends. What we have to do is to bridge the gulf between imperfect attentiveness and the perfect attentiveness. And it is only where there is the perfect attentiveness that we are attentive as fully mature human beings. Until then, there is the mixture of the human and the animal in us. And this mixture of the human and animal prevents us from being a pure animal, and therefore we are beastly. No animal can do the dreadful evil things that human beings can do. No animal at all. It is we who are capable of unbelievable devilry. And this is because there is this muddlement, this conflict, this tied-upness in horrible knots in the psyche and in the manner in which we attend. As long as we attend self-orientedly, we are drawing the world unto ourselves and only trying to draw the world to ourselves. Now the difference between us doing that, us humans doing that, and the animal doing that, is just this. That the animal draws unto himself willy-nilly. He has no option in the matter. He is constituted that way by nature. He draws unto himself only what is essential for his existence. He is in tune with the natural laws of his being. In the case of the wild animals, the beasts of prey, we say the law of the jungle. But it is quite right for the tiger to spring upon his prey and eat it. But having satisfied the need for food for the continuation of his existence, that's the finish. There is no such thing as revenge or any deliberate cruelty or anything like that in the animal world. There is up to a point, of course, we do know that, but it is minimal as compared with what we humans can do. Now, when we draw to ourselves, we draw to ourselves not only what are the essential needs for the existence in the world, food, warmth, shelter, just essential needs, but the impure mind conjures up all kinds of wants and greeds and passions and whims and appetites and whatnot to complicate the whole mental organism. The psyche as an organism is a wonderfully complex thing. And do remember that wherever there is greater complexity, there is much greater potentiality for the more marvelous, the more beautiful, the more perfect. You see it in art, for instance, the great art forms. They are more and more complex, but there is no complication when a genius produces a work of art. If you take a Bach fugue, for instance, it's a wonderfully complex thing, but there is no complication in it. If it got complicated, you wouldn't hear a lovely fugue. You'd hear a funny mixture of noises. It's like that. So complexity marks development, refinement, progress, and so forth. Complication marks disease and something which has gone wrong. Now, our minds are complicated. This is the point. Because of these, we have not understood how these different urges within us, broadly the natural urges on the one hand and the pull of transcendence on the other, operate in us. And therefore, we do not set our sights upon transcendence. If we set our sights upon transcendence, then there is every chance for fulfilling the purpose of our existence. And this is where our religiousness comes in. If we set our sights upon transcendence, what we experience as our natural, the natural drives of ambition and achievement and so forth, which we have quite rightly and naturally, when we are young and when we are adolescent, all those, all that energy gets directed into the right channel as we grow older and older. And the right channel means that this fruition into our perfect humanity takes first place. And if that takes first place, we see all the other things in our lives as unessential for this fruition. And when we really see that and are well aware of all the reactions from within ourselves to all that happens in everyday life, then we don't experience any conflict to relinquish and renounce those unessential things. True relinquishment, true renunciation is not a painful thing. It is a thing of joy and happiness for the very simple reason that you are relieved of a disease of the mind, and for the first time you know what it means to be free and harmonious within your mind. The healthy body is the happy body, and it is happy naturally and spontaneously. There is no grasping. There is no fevered desire to possess this, that, or the other. You are just naturally and naturally happy. And you don't know it with your brain that, oh, I'm happy, I'm healthy, I'm fine. You don't know that at all. You just are it. And this is the important part of it. Now, in the same way, when the mind sort of emerges out of its complications, becomes clear-seeing, becomes free of all its self-orientedness, then the mind also becomes mature. And it becomes mature not because it has been deliberately patterned into something which is thought of as maturity, but which is the true living maturity of the human mind, which human beings know nothing about until they have achieved it, realized it. This is the extraordinary part. Does the body, for example, try to achieve maturity? Not a bit of it. You may take exercises, you may take care of your diet, you may do a few simple things like that, but the maturing of the body is life's process, nature's gift. You can't do anything about it. It matures. And with the body, it matures willy-nilly, whether you will or not. By the time you have passed puberty a few years and so forth, and you're in your 20s, the body is mature. There it is. You can't say no to it. With the mind, it's your responsibility. It rests with you to do this. And this is the great significance of withinness, self-consciousness. When this happens, you will find that the manner in which you attend to the whole of life is undergoing a complete transformation. You are attending to everything without desiring anything. Desiring it possessively. If you don't desire possessively, you're free of ambition. If you're free of ambition, you're free of competition, you're free of conflict with your neighbor, you're free of envy, you're free of jealousy, and so forth and so forth. You become free of all the ills. You become free of pride and conceit because you wake up to the fact that one that you don't know. And in that is your freedom. Now, don't misunderstand what I have said. Of course, one knows one's arithmetic and algebra and anatomy and physiology and harmony and counterpoint and all the rest of it. One knows all that. Those are the external techniques of expression. But when you say, I know, in the sense that I truly understand the fact of the thing, then I'm telling a lie. Because all that I mean when I say I know in that sense is my particular mental construct of it. And my particular mental construct is the construct of a mind that is immature. In short, if I were to say positively like that I know this, that and the other, I am practically affirming omniscience. But when one is free from all that, one is totally attending without grasping, there is no selfness involved in it. And with the absence of selfness, the senses function in utter purity. You know, we rarely experience that in life, this pure functioning of the senses. And the joy and the happiness that is associated with it. When you come upon something, say, very beautiful, a wonderful sunset or a lovely starlit night or some wonderful daffodils sun-flooded in spring or something like that, you see, you suddenly come upon it like that, unexpectedly, naturally, spontaneously, your heart wells out in joy. And if you're sensible, you don't go off the deep end and start chattering to your neighbor and say, oh, look at those daffodils, aren't they wonderful? And just spoil the silent beauty and harmony of the whole situation. You just are one with it. That is the time when you are attending unself-consciously. There is no selfness involved in that, you see. And then you don't grasp the joy and say, oh, I want to repeat that tomorrow and day after, and so it will never happen again. What happens is what happens in the immediate now. And in that is your fulfillment. Now, when you are attending in that way, pure intelligence functions. It's impossible to describe this sort of thing, the way in which pure intelligence functions. But there are certain simple things one may bear in mind in this connection. When pure intelligence functions, you will find that your heart is full of peace, it is full of compassion, it is totally free of any reactions which bring about disharmony between yourself and your environment. And this is the nature of true happiness within oneself. Although the external situation may be a painful one, may be a sad one, we hear the news of Guatemala and this terrible disaster which has overtaken that land. 22,000 dead, so many thousands and thousands homeless, and so forth. This is painful. This is terrible. Man has to endure this. But if intelligence, pure intelligence functions together with this associated compassion, it wells out from within you, and neither you nor I know the ways in which this energy which goes out from us functions and helps the world. So you see, there is religiousness come to fruition within one. And the mode of awareness, your mode of awareness has become utterly transformed from the worldly mode, which is the self-seeking mode, into the transcendent mode, which is the mode in which through you these these divine energies, which we name transcendence, wisdom, truth, beauty, goodness, they all function through you, actually function through your own physical body, through your brain, through your nerves, in the way you look, in the way you listen, and so forth, in everything. And this is what marks the person whose mind has come to perfect maturity. This is human fulfillment. The perfected Holy One is like that. And the perfected Holy One is the true specimen of humanity. Too long have we separated holiness, religion, and the good life in its real meaning from the worldly life. If you and I, the few of us who are here, can set our sights off on transcendence, realize this through living disciplined lives, that doesn't mean a forced conformity with something that is laid down, but disciplined by virtue of being observant, intensely observant, alert all the time, alert in the right way. Most people are alert in life because they're always looking for gain for themselves, and gain for themselves always means exploiting your neighbor in some way or other. You can't deliberately seek gain. You have to exploit your neighbor. You're free from all that. And then we shall see quite a new world emerge. Because the few have seen, have understood, and are conscious they are alive in the right way. You know how if you're carrying out some chemical experiments, you may mix two perfectly clear solutions and you'll get a precipitate at once. And then, if you add just one drop of another liquid, the whole precipitate disappears, and once again there is absolute transparency and clarity. That one drop does it. Now you see, the Holy One, you yourself, in any particular moment of illumination, of realized transcendence, suddenly there with you, are like that drop affecting the muddied life of the world, clarifies it. This is what we have to bear in mind. If we undertake religious disciplines in order to bring about a preconceived good result, then we are acting just like any other selfish person, self-centered person. But just attend completely, wholly, in the right way. Then you'll respond in the right way. And the worldly consciousness will be transformed into the transcendent awareness of totality, of which you are an integral part and parcel.